From the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, KUAR Public Radio brings you Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, the only program on radio today dedicated to the preservation of comparative generational thought, with your host, Phil Marriage. Welcome to the Crossroads of History.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another 2013 edition of Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow here in Little Rock. I'm Phil Marriage, your host. I'm really glad you guys can join us here today for a discussion, I think, on a topic that's been really in the news quite a bit lately. It goes hot and cold. We'll hear a lot of stories about this topic, and then it kind of settles down. And then we hear a few more stories, and it always has to do with some news event in this topic. We'll be talking today about sports injuries. But I do want to tell you at the outset of the program, if you'd like to listen to the longer version of our program, all you have to do is go to KUAR.org and click on Programs. We're at the very tail end of that under Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. You'll see a list of several of our programs we've had in the past, and you can just listen to them there in that longer form. As we begin the program today, I want to take you back to October 2nd, 1936. A young fellow by the name of John Allen Adams, he was a junior at Arkadelphia High School. He was in his last football game of the season there with Malvern. He was a running back, and he sat up after a play, and he was tackled from behind in a late hit, forcing him forward and compressing his head into his chest. It paralyzed him from the chest down, and he was carried off the field by his coaches and rushed to the hospital. But back in 1936, it really was a lot different than it is today. He did spend the next 40 years, plus years of his life, confined to a wheelchair apparatus that really looks archaic if you saw the pictures of it. And he was one of the longest living quadriplegics until he died. And he's remembered even today as one of the finest scholars and poets of the Arkadelphia community, having his own bookstore there for many years. And one of our guests, my older generation guest, is Dr. Woody Jolly. I don't know, Dr. Jolly, did you remember the name John Allen Adams?
I really don't. I was in school here from 1960 to 64.
Well, those people that live in the Arkadelphia area in that vicinity who are probably much in that older generation would remember that name. But his injury speaks to the very same thing that we're going to be talking today, as how sports injuries were handled over time compared to now. And I think we'll find a lot of different interesting comments about that. The voice you just heard there was Dr. Woody Jolly. He's a professor at Henderson State University, and he played football and ran track there at Henderson from 1960 through 1964, where they won the AIC championship in his senior year in football. And he received several injuries during his days there at Henderson. One was a broken arm. He had three concussions and three shoulder separations. The first aid for all of these really was done by the coaches, because they didn't really even have trainers back then. Dr. Woody Jolly, thanks for being with us and joining us here today from Arkadelphia.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And then speaking from the middle generation is Sue Carver. She's in the studio with us here today, and she's a physical therapist here at UAMS. Sue Carver, glad to have you here.
Thank you.
And our younger generation perspective is coming from Michael Switlick. He's a certified athletic trainer and the head athletic trainer for UALR Athletics here, and he serves as the primary athletic trainer for men's basketball, cross-country, track and field, and both of the golf teams. So, Michael Switlick, glad to have you here.
It's a pleasure.
Getting into the discussion right away, I do want to begin with you, Dr. Woody Jolly. Going back to your playing days, I guess even before college, where I mentioned those injuries, what are your recollections about sports injuries at that time?
Well, of course, we didn't have the education that coaches are required to take now. All they had was probably a basic course in first aid, and none of them knew anything about training, for that matter, or injuries in particular. And I can remember, you know, just during practices during two-a-days when it was so hot, we weren't even allowed to have water or ice. I can remember my junior year, we were finally allowed to have, we'd get three little cubes of ice is all we could have all during practice. And, of course, it was just wasn't any reason except for the fact that we just weren't educated as to the importance of, or the coaches weren't educated in terms of the importance of hydrating kids and letting them. It's a wonder. I don't know how we all kept from dying from heat stroke back then. And of course, we didn't have the air conditioning like we do now. And I think we were acclimated better to it at that time. But I know even when I got in college, and we had expanded our curriculum for coaches to care and treatment, prevention and treatment of athletic injuries, which got into a little bit more of how to treat injuries, tape ankles and that sort of thing. But, you know, it just wasn't hardly done back in the 50s and 60s.
Now, I do want to ask you one question about the mental attitude, both in the athletes and the coaching staffs, that you were supposed to just be tough and get through things.
That's it was part of the atmosphere and psychology to suck it up and be tough. I can't tell you how many times I've seen coach. In fact, I was been guilty of it when I first started coaching. You didn't know whether a kid was really, really hurt or just faking. We'd go out there many times. It just scares me to death about how I used to tell those kids, come on, get up, you're not hurt, you know. you learn the personality of those kids in practice, and some of them tend to use any kind of ploy to get out of practice or get out of a little tough work, and you do that, and it just scares me to death how many times that I could have really seriously damaged a kid or from an injury by not being more careful. The parents, of course, were not on the practice field most of the time, and most of those kind of things happened on the practice field. But in game-like situations, we always were lucky. I started coaching at Pulaski Heights Junior High School back in 1964-65, and we had a physician on the field all the time during games. But never did we have trainers, never did we have physicians at practice and that kind of stuff. We were just expected to take care of that kind of stuff ourselves, you know.
Michael, how does it sound different now?
The presence of an athletic trainer, particularly at high school games, is still probably a relatively new evolution. I know when I was playing football here in Little Rock in the late 80s, again, our sideline medical presence was someone's dad who's a doctor or someone's mom who's a nurse. So, I mean, even some of that was still relatively new to me when I was at that point. When I graduated from grad school, that's when, for me, I started getting in, you know, the outreach programs where you work for a sports medicine clinic. And you went and covered sports, and that was a much more daily regimen for you, you know, checking on student athletes at the high school and also covering home events. Mm-hmm. From a consistent basis, relatively, it was starting to come around for you when in the 80s, you know, that was starting to come around.
I moved to Little Rock in 1989, and I'm an athletic trainer as well as a physical therapist. So when I came, it was to start a sports medicine practice here. I found out there was only either 3 to 5 certified trainers in the whole state of Arkansas.
And those were probably predominantly at universities, weren't they? Probably
right.
At that time,
and
yeah.
So we wanted to provide some coverage for the high schools. So I reached out to some of the students at UCA that were there that were certified trainers, and we ended up having 4 or 5 trainers. And we would go out and cover some of the high schools' practices and games. But I was amazed that there was nothing in place because I come from Virginia originally, and they had athletic trainers in the high school. And so it was really surprising to me.
Woody, let me ask you, what was it like when you first saw or felt the pressure to have a trainer involved with sports? Was it something you guys welcomed, or did you question what was going on, or how did it start?
Well, when I came here, I came from Little Rock School District in 1990 down here as chair of the physical education department. We had a hired athletic trainer, and I think Henderson was one, like UCA, one of the first that had a certified athletic trainer, a guy named Terry DeWitt. He's been a pioneer. In fact, he started our academic athletic training program, and now we have probably 25 or 30 student athletic trainers. But Terry was a big part of that, getting it going. And he, like they did at UCA, he'd take his trainees and take them out to the high schools around here, Arkadelphia and Gurdon and Prescott and Malvern, and provide a trainer for them on Friday nights. But, you know, like during the week, they didn't have trainers. The coaches still had to take care of those kind of. But I know now with all these trainers, that's part of their internship. They have to be out and service these schools even during the week. They do internship hours.
I was going to say the National Athletic Trainers Association is not that old. It was first started in 1950. And it wasn't until 1970 that women came into the profession. I think there was like at the first meeting a little over 125 trainers, and now there's 30,000 plus. Mm-hmm. And about half of them are women. So probably...
Was that because of Title IX?
I think Title IX was a big push, but I also think as a result of injuries that we saw in football, like this is an interesting fact that I found in 1905, President Roosevelt was threatening to abolish football because of 18 deaths and 159 serious injuries.
Wow.
Because what they used to do is mass tackling, and, you know, the equipment was not as good as it is today. Also, the NC2A was formed to protect athletes and to start organization, but it was very early in its infancy. I think the NC2A came in 1906.
Woody Jolly, let me ask you about the injuries I outlined at the beginning of our program here today that you sustained. How have they affected you over the course of your life, and what kind of treatment did you get for your injuries?
It's really remarkable. I can remember the first injury I had here at Henderson. I broke my arm, took the opening kickoff against Arkansas Tech. They ran me under the bench over there, and I got up. My arm was broken right above my wrist. One of the coaches grabbed it, and he was going to pull it back in place. And it just, I went to my knees with pain, you know. But here's what's interesting. We didn't have trainers. We didn't have anybody back then. And they took the student manager, took me in the car and took me to the hospital at Russellville. And they set my arm. I woke up out there in the hall at Russellville on a gurney with nobody around. Nobody was there. But I was just left there by myself like that. But the point I'm trying to make is the coach just knew that I just had dislocated my wrist, and he was going to pull it back in place. Of course, it was broken up there. But that's the kind of stuff that we just, you know, there wasn't any training as such, per se, for that kind of injury or any kind of injury, really. So he didn't know what to do except just try to pull it back in place.
We hear all the time about knee injuries and this kind of surgery and that kind of surgery. What did they do about knee injuries then?
Well, they pretty much sent them to the doctor. Of course, you know, a knee injury is usually if it's torn, got a torn ligament or something, it's not cartilage. They're not going to want to be able to walk on it. A player can't get back in the game usually, and the next day they have it x-rayed. And as good as x-rays were back then, you know, it still weren't good enough to tell you. You know, the MRIs are so much better now. But, you know, they have ways of checking those knees now to determine almost immediately whether they've got a torn ligament or not. So it's changed considerably, I think. I got knocked out at opening kickoff one time, took it, and I woke up in the dressing room, in the training room, and there on the table by myself. They had just taken me in there and left me, you know. And I guess the managers came in there and checked on me every once in a while to make sure I was still breathing. But I woke up at half in there on the table in the dressing room.
Well, Sue Carver, talking about concussions, because that's what we hear in the news a lot. As you've seen concussions over time compared to what Michael sees now.
I can tell you one thing that I used to do is if I had a football player and he had a concussion and he couldn't answer some of the questions that I was asking him, I would take his football helmet because otherwise they'd just run back into the game. And we know that multiple concussions can lead to major problems down the road, memory loss, that sort of thing. In fact, I have a friend now that played professional football and has Parkinson's, and of course they're relating Parkinson's and long-term traumas to some of these head injury. You know, when you think about the boxers and how much hitting they take to the head, Muhammad Ali is one that we think about. You know,
she mentioned taking the helmet away from the player. I know our trainers now have the authority. If they don't want a kid to go back in the game, the coach cannot override. If the trainer says he's not to go back in the game, That's a rule. We don't allow them back in.
Yeah, I'm not sure about Division II or III, but I know in Division I, they passed a rule two or three seasons ago to where if they have any symptoms or any signs of a concussion, they're done for that day. Right. Practice or game, championship, doesn't matter. So you've got, with those sorts of rules now, you've got some ammunition behind you so that when you do say this person has a concussion, then everyone knows, well, this is the process you're going to take. They're shut down for the day. We'll continue our evaluations, and then we're going to work towards some sort of gradual return to play once we deem them over those signs and symptoms of that brain trauma. You know, I just showed my class. I teach the prevention and care class for the coaching majors at ULR. I just had them watch the Frontline episode on the NFL, their troubles with that. And I think now there's just, you just have to take it much more seriously because you do have that, you still have that influence of wanting to get back out there, shake it off, and that is still a little bit present. But, and sometimes it's not just necessarily coaches. I think sometimes mm-hmm. athletes have that competitive spirit at lots of different levels.
And it's also good if you have, if the athletes, you educate the athletes, if you see one of your team members not acting appropriately, please let us know because it could be their, you know, safety in terms of not having a long-term injury.
Let me diverge just a little bit from the main topic here and ask Sue Carver about the female end of sports injuries. Is it much different than the male end of sports injuries?
Well, I think early on you didn't see the training, the conditioning in women that you saw in men. And because of body build, you may have seen different types of injuries. Like for women, I think in basketball, ACL, anterior cruciate ligament injuries was a big one. And sometimes that is geared towards technique, conditioning, and sometimes how anatomically that knee is formed, where it may predispose the ligament to being injured more. But I think most of your injuries are similar. We don't see as many head injuries because we're not in contact sports that much. You could accidentally have something happen, you know, on the field, like playing field hockey or somebody colliding with another person by accident. But, you know, we're not. Well, I guess women are boxing now.
Woody Jolly, when do you remember seeing women come into athletics and the injuries that you might have seen for them?
Well, we didn't have athletics for women when I was in school. They didn't play volleyball or basketball or any of that. They did, I think, some in the summer in AAU. But I saw it, the transition from when I started back in 65 coaching in junior high. I saw how the girls' athletics progressed from being, you know, where we started out in the Little Rock School District. I know they played volleyball first, and they had a little gymnastics, and they ran track. And now it's expanded where they have, of course, the softball and basketball and tennis and golf and all of those sports that Title IX has required us to do. But it's one interesting thing that I think it's kind of amusing. I remember in junior high meet back in the 60s, we used to have huge meets over at Scott Field in Little Rock, and we'd have the field be covered up with athletes. We'd run junior high girls, junior high boys, senior high girls, and senior high boys. And I remember lining up to run the 400-yard dash. That's what we ran, 440-yard dash one time. And I was a starter, and I looked down there, and there was a little junior high girl, obviously very pregnant. And I thought, my gosh, I can't believe this. Surely her coach knows this. But we shot the gun. Of course, everybody kind of laughed about it. She won the race. And it shocked everybody. But that's, you know, that's kind of where we've come in terms of girls training and being able to recognize what they can do from a physical standpoint. And,
well, you know, it was pretty interesting because back in the early days, they thought women were going to hurt their internal organs, and they limited what they could do. I can remember I played that basketball where you had rovers and you couldn't cross the center line until I went to college, and then we went to a five-player game. And it's amazing how women's sports have changed. I mean, you watch Diana Nyad and swim from Cuba to Florida. You know, women are capable of really doing amazing things from an athletic standpoint.
I want to take the discussion a little bit into the I guess you'd say, the pharmacological aspect of injuries. How do drugs fit into what your memory is of sports injury?
I never received any kind of shots, you know, cortisone shots. I know some people did, I think, but I never had any of those, and never had any that were associated with any of the athletes that I coached. They may have got them on the side that I didn't know about, but we didn't. I don't know of any of those.
Sue?
Yes, I'm aware of people getting cortisone shots, and cortisone can be very beneficial because it can help decrease the inflammation in an area and help you heal a little bit more quickly. But the problem with it is, because it masks pain, if you do an injection and then have someone go out and participate, it also weakens protein tissue, so you have the likelihood of a rupture of a ligament or a tendon, and so then it becomes questionable about the use. Mm-hmm. I see it particularly in runners that want to continue to run that have plantar fasciitis. They'll go and get a cortisone injection and continue to run. Well, they're really putting themselves at risk for having a rupture.
Well, Michael, can you guys recognize, or is it a part of the practice of a trainer to recommend cortisone or any other thing? I don't really know the other ones that might be available.
Absolutely not. I mean, you know, my license is signed by our team physician, and so I'm providing care through his direction. And so it's up to the team physician to determine whether or not that's an appropriate therapy.
Well, Woody Jolly, but when the important players are playing with injuries, where are the pressures as a coach to try and keep that all-powerful person in the game?
I think the rules, particularly on college level, the trainer has the authority to say whether a kid can play or not. And a trainer, as much as more so than the coach, knows whether a guy is hurt and does not need to be in the game. And with that kind of authority, I can't see it happening. I'm sure it probably does in some cases, maybe where a coach has a lot of authority over the trainer in terms of hiring and firing him, but I still think that he'd be jeopardizing his job if he overruled a trainer and put a guy in that, when the trainer said he's not ready, doesn't need to be in the game. So I'm not sure. I'd like to share an interesting story to you that I think is funny, that most of you know who Keith Jackson is. It does the Razorback games, played for Oklahoma. He was at Parkview when I was coaching there. Of course, an outstanding athlete, the best athlete I've ever coached in my life. His senior year, we were undefeated and getting ready to play Little Rock Central, who was undefeated at the same time. And we played Pine Bluff the week before, and he got his shoulder dislocated. We called it knocked down. We took him to the doctor, and they x-rayed it, and they, you know, said that it was probably needed to stay out for 2 or 3 weeks. Of course, we're getting ready to play. They're undefeated. We're undefeated, and we got to have him. And Ken Turner was recruiting him big time at Fayetteville at the time. And he said, Woody, I don't know whether it'll help or not, but you might try something. And this was like Tuesday or Wednesday before we played on Friday night. And he said, there's a chiropractor there named Terry Simmons that does acupuncture. And he said, you might take him over there and just see what he might could do. Well, I'm telling you, Keith could not raise his arm barely above his waist. And we're talking about we got to have him. We're going to win that game, so we're desperate. So I take him over there to Terry, and he x-rays him and looks at it. He says, well, let's try. It won't hurt. We'll try acupuncture. He hooks some little electrodes up to those needles. And, of course, no pain, no blood or anything. And we were there for about 30, 45 minutes. He pulled those needles out, and you would have to have been there to see it. It was just like Oral Roberts had laid hands on that shoulder. He could raise his arm up above his head. He swung it around like it was just like a miracle had happened right in front of me. Of course, I still don't know how it works, how that acupuncture works, but it was absolutely, Keith and I both were amazing. We played Friday night, and he scored 2 touchdowns, and we won.
How was his shoulder?
His shoulder, well, it was well enough that we felt comfortable letting him play. He didn't hurt it or anything. And
I mean, there's so much more education and different types of treatments you can do today that was not available early on. I mean, we were just talking about PRP, which is a plasma-rich protein that they're using now to heal tendon injuries. And pretty soon we're going to be seeing stem cells for regeneration of cartilage. And I've had acupuncture before. It's very effective.
I'll give a little bit of an opposite. For me, I've really focused currently in our treatment protocols really based on what's called clinical-based approach. Right. What you're doing has to have some sort of evidence-based. It's got to have some rationale to it, and it needs to have empirical reviewed. So that's usually where we focus on in our athletic training room. If someone wants to go after some sort of alternative, then they're free to do that.
I don't think it's a new term applied to sports injuries, the term sports medicine. And, of course, UAMS here has the sports medicine. Sports medicine, what does that mean, Sue Carver?
Well, I mean, it's treating injuries, particularly sports injuries, specific to sports injuries. But it is, as he said, using the clinical research and applying that clinical research to treat the injuries. There are other options out there. Not only are there the high school college athletes, which is what he's dealing with, but you have your recreational athletes that are out there.
Is that what you see it?
I do geriatric sports medicine now because I work at...
Oh, cool.
Well, I call it geriatric sports medicine, but I work in the senior center at UAMS, and it's amazing what, if people continue to train and exercise and work out, how active they can be in their later years. And so we really encourage all of our people, if they come in with injuries, once we get them on a program, we say, you don't stop once you feel better. This is a lifetime thing.
Well, Michael Switlick, do you guys as trainers recognize injuries that could be long-term problems for people, and how do you handle that?
Well, absolutely. You know, it's all about the initial care that we give them now. You know, it's about recognizing what we need to do now to make sure they're returned to play to a certain level so that we're not putting them back maybe too soon. You know, that whole discussion of what you're talking about, that star player that needs to get back out there. That's what sports medicine's about. You've got, to me, you got your general practice, your general medicine, which is great, but you've got, you know, sports medicine kind of diverges from that, and it pushes that envelope a little bit of what can we do and how soon can we get them back out there on the field.
Well, you know, in physical therapy, it's a little bit different because, you know, you're limited by the number of visits that the insurance company will give the person. And so a lot of times what we find is we have to discharge them just at the point where we could really be doing some things with them. You know, you got their strength level up a little bit. Now we need to work some agility and do some other things like that. But we don't have any visits left.
The bad news time, when you've had an athlete who has suffered injury that is really career-ending to that sport, how do you handle that?
Honesty. You just got to be up front with them. There's no way of trying to I guess for lack of a better phrase, sugarcoat or make it simple. You just got to be up front and do your best to show, you know, I mean, there's compassion, and but then there's empathy. And so you just got to be able to provide that balance there of being honest, but yet not too, you know, overly, you know, emotional about it yourself. You got to kind of be that pillar for them because they're, it's going to obviously affect them emotionally.
Well, going back to what I said at the very outset of the program of John Allen Adams, who was became a quadriplegic in 1936 and spent the rest of his life in a wheelchair. What is different from an athlete who hears a story from you that are you guys that their career is over and they ask about all the changes that have happened since his time in 1936, especially in paralysis, to now? Do they not ask you what's new, what's the latest?
For his situation, just to use that, just to kind of start that discussion, is that, you know, our on-field management is so much different than what he experienced. If we see someone who's gone down with that type of cervical or head injury, I mean, everyone knows that, that you're going to treat this by stabilizing the spine. We're not moving them until we've assessed them. And, we've got a protocol in place that we're going to handle this a certain way to minimize any kind of future damage.
Can you tell that right away when they're on the field that that's the injury that they've gotten? Is it an immediate alarm?
Well, if you suspect it, you're going to assess and treat it as if it's a potential spine injury.
Yeah, you
don't want to take a chance with it.
I had a paramedic that taught our EMT class at Arkansas that said, if you suspect a head injury, suspect a spine injury or cervical injury. If you suspect a cervical injury, suspect a head injury. So you're going under, well, I know assuming things isn't always the best thing to do, but in that situation, you're going in with worst case scenario. We're going to treat them. I mean, how many times you see NFL or professional players being hauled off on a stretcher because of the fact that we just want to make sure that we're going to do this the right way to minimize the chances of any kind of, you know, having what happened to that gentleman on the field, having him sit up maybe too soon or something of that nature. It's amazing how just starting on the field the right way can help prevent. I think the greatest contrast to the scenario you're bringing to us is the gentleman at Rutgers that had his bed. Look at his quality of life is greatly probably drastic to that gentleman because that damage was done. But it was managed appropriately on the field and afterwards in the hospital and things. And look at him now. He's in a chair that allows him to get away wherever he wants. Mm-hmm. He's got the ability to communicate. He's got the ability to finish college. I mean, the technology for people who've suffered that kind of catastrophic event is so much better than it was in 1936.
Do you remember when they used to think that the best thing to do after surgery on a knee was to put it in a cast immobilizer? Then they found they couldn't bend the knee again, so guess what? You now have passive range of motion machines moving your knee immediately after surgery.
Well, we've been talking about sports injuries here today on Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. I do want to thank my guest for being with me here today, Dr. Woody Jolly, a professor at Henderson State University, where he played through 1960 through 1964. Woody, let me thank you so much for being with us here.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Sue Carver has been here with me from the middle generation perspective. Sue Carver is a physical therapist here at UAMS. Sue, thanks for being with us here today. And then also from the younger generation perspective, Michael Switlick. He's a certified athletic trainer here at UALR. He's the head athletic trainer for men's basketball, cross country, track and field, and both golf teams. Michael, thanks for being here today.
Again, my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Folks, if you happen to have a student in high school who's playing in athletics and you've been worried about them getting injured, I think after listening to this program today, you probably are aware of the fact that training and physical training and trainers and the coaches are well aware of the hazards with those sports, and they're not going to take your kids into areas they shouldn't as far as sports injuries are concerned. And if they do happen to get injured, sounds like there's quite a bit out there. Again, thanks for listening to the program today. You can catch the longer version at our website at kuar.org. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow is a production of KUAR Public Radio, Little Rock.